Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, Emmanuel. Lovely to have you. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Keisha.
So we know you here at Label Sessions as someone who's, you know, whose expertise are in futures, trends, and culture, but specifically with, you know, a passion for diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. I guess before we dive into all of those topics and kind of ideas, could you give our listeners a quick intro about yourself and, you know, how you became a futurist?
I'd love to. So my name is Emmanuel Naranjo. I was born in the state of California in the country of the U.S., a proud daughter of two immigrant parents found in the country of Mexico. I grew up in Los Angeles, currently trilingual. I speak English, Brazilian Portuguese, and Mexican Spanish. Also in the process of learning Italian. I'm a big fan of animal memes, so anything with cats, raccoons, or possums, they bring me such joy. And how I became a futurist is very interesting because I took a non-traditional path to it. And I went from my background in fashion, first retail, then like personal styling and editorial styling, and then pivoted that into trend research and trend forecasting. And through that sector and industry, I stumbled upon future studies and strategic foresight. And then from there, I partnered up with someone who went to school for strategic foresight, and we did a couple of passion projects. And then that led me to connecting with the current collective and futures think tank that I'm a part of named Radar. And over the past 2 years, I've been collaborating with them and contributing research to their three future reports. I've also collaborated with the London-based agency Protein for one of their Jody Awards reports that they do. And the topic was on community, which, given my background and interest in everything intersectionality and culture, was really great. In particular, it was on the chapter I contributed research to was on community spaces, both online and virtual, which I think is an interesting topic. And then I also have contributed research and cultural strategy and insights on a project with the Sao Paulo-based Box 1824 agency, which is really fun. And most recently, I participated in a seminar series for Women Who Futures, and I gave a talk on the importance of intersectionality in future studies and strategic foresight.
Absolutely incredible. And all the things are, you know, it's a mixture of the things that you said that are very sort of cultural and on the internet and all those things, but also stuff that is so relevant to just people in their general lives and businesses as well. So, no, absolutely fascinating. I wonder, to go right to the basics, and for the sake of, you know, people like myself who a couple of months ago didn't know what, you know, a futurist, futurologist is, I wonder, could you explain almost in your words, what does a futurist do? And also almost how do you do it? So I know like lots of different people do it in different ways, but what's your personal approach?
It's interesting because I refer to myself as a futurist synthesist, and that term was coined by Cecilia Tam, who's based in Barcelona currently and heads the Futurity Studios. And so essentially a futurist is someone who looks at what we call signals of change. Sometimes they might call it drivers of change. And we look at these signals and look at the drivers behind them, societal, technological, economic, ecological, political. And then we see how these are all connected. And then depending on the project or the client, we then use more of a specified lens to figure out how this will impact either the client in question or a community or for those who work more in policy-oriented roles, like a country or a city. So we're always engaging in what's known as horizon scanning. So looking at different things, it can be an article, a prototype, a poem, a tweet. And as long as it looks like it has some impact on the future, we can consider that a signal of change. And then weaving that all together, then there's different methodologies that people use, like causal layer analysis, the futures cone, the three horizons, which is horizon one is like 10 years, and then horizon two is like more like horizon one is 5 years, and horizon two is 10, and then horizon three is like 20 plus years. So different futurists engage in like different methodologies. Myself, personally, I like to use what's known as effective foresight. So effective foresight centers emotion in my sense making. So I'm focusing on how current emotions and also to potential future emotions can affect people's perspective of the future, and also to centering that when I'm having discussions and participating in research and strategic foresight projects. Because since I'm a firm believer in intersectionality, I want to make sure that I allow space for people to share 100% of themselves. And it's really important to hearing how they feel, because how they feel presently will affect their perspective of the future. And a lot of times people may silo others by thinking like, oh, young people are always going to have positive emotions about the future. That's not always necessarily the case. The same with those who may be in the middle stages and later stages in life, they might be thinking, oh, they're too jaded. Like they're probably like pessimistic, nihilistic. When some of the people that I've had conversations with that are much older than me have the most hopeful and brightest visions of the future, and that inspires me. So I mentioned future synthesis. And so what a future synthesis does is they take the perspective of futurists and then like a strategist and then a researcher, and they implement all of those different sectors into their framework and methodologies. So I don't just use one methodology, I use various. And I'm more qualitative oriented because I believe that it's very important to highlight that these are human beings behind data points, that there are stories, and that these stories carry a nuance that a lot of times when people are looking into insights and strategy, they're just kind of looking at the present instead of looking at the future, without recognizing that when you're looking at the future, that provides longevity, and long-term thinking is beneficial to all your teams, because then it provides the atmosphere and the environment to nourish future talent. And especially in a corporate context, that can help minimize, you know, having to spend a lot of money looking externally and, you know, having to re-educate someone from an external background about your organization's culture. And I know for some corporations and organizations, how they have their strategic pillars regarding their culture, it's very specific and very nuanced. So if you haven't been there for a while and you're having a new hire, especially someone in the C-suite, it can be overwhelming sometimes. And we've seen it happen where there's that disconnect of the external hire. And then when they hire someone internally, it's like they have amazing results.
And on that point, I think that you discussed about, you know, how someone feels is the way that they go about its life, make decisions, whether professionally or personally. I wonder, since that you said you're super interested in kind of DEI initiatives, how do you see DEI kind of influencing and also being influenced by, you know, social shifts and societal shifts and, you know, emerging tech? You know, how do you see the stuff that's going on now that people are perhaps at least outwardly seeing, portraying as being more important or something we should focus on, being influenced or influencing stuff that's going on now, stuff that's going on and could possibly happen in the future?
It's a very interesting time right now for DEI because, and I'm for reference for everyone listening, I'm coming in from my experience here in the U.S. And someone from the global north and the west. But here in the U.S., we're getting a lot of pushback from legislation and legislators because they don't see the value in DEI. For example, in states like Florida and other states where they're pushing back against initiatives such as affirmative action and critical race theory. But it's really important because as this world continues to be more globalized and we're getting smaller and smaller connection-wise via technology, it's a disservice to have a country citizens not be acclimated to interacting with people from other parts of the world, especially if you're doing business. You know, like if you haven't had the opportunity to learn about all other cultures, have that open mindset, for example, you could be doing a business deal with someone in South America and not be aware of the cultural faux pas there. And you could literally cost a company like a multi-billion dollar deal. And the same with other parts of the world. Like there's these cultural nuances that a lot of times we aren't taught in school or aren't provided the opportunity to be encouraged to learn about them, because the world is a big place. Not everyone is going to be the same as yourself. Not everyone's going to share the same intersectional identities as you. And I feel like from an economic business standpoint, it benefits your organization, your corporation, your brand monetarily, because you have research indicated from McKinsey, for example, that businesses that have more diversity are 33%, if I remember the statistic correctly, more successful than their competitors, especially in the C-suite. And we have been seeing right now on a global level, more and more people from disenfranchised or marginalized communities and groups being more outspoken and more solidarity and unity on a global level of people from different intersectional identities. And especially the younger generations, like millennials and Gen Z, have both vocalized that they are less likely to accept a job or an offer from a company or brand that doesn't align with their morals and ethics. And at least here in the US, they're forecasted by like the 2030s to make up 66% of the country's workforce. And so that says a lot, because on a global level, more and more people from millennials and Gen Z are expressing this in, you know, the workplace. And as someone who's interested in the future of work, I think that's always important to share those insights with companies and brands and let them know, like, hey, if you want to be making money in the next 5 to 10 years, this is what's going on currently, and this is how it's going to influence the future. We're seeing it on, once again, global level. It's not just happening in little pockets of more progressive liberal cities. It's happening globally, and people are getting to a point where they've just had enough, and they recognize that they need to be valued as a human being, not only in the workplace, but in the country that they live in.
Yeah, definitely. And the way that, I guess, kind of you're phrasing it is, you know, when you're talking to these executives or people who don't quite understand about the importance of DEI, it's like, okay, let's put that aside. If you're not investing in this, if you're not putting your kind of your attention onto this, you may be losing money. Like it's a benefit to you and your business in, you know, strategy, money, in success to be thinking about these things. It's not just something that's, you know, just nice and, you know, that's woke and all of that. It's like, no, it's bringing benefit to you as well. It's interesting how you came at that, like different views as well.
It also helps that there's research, for example, the World 50 Group, they put out their Inclusion and Diversity Impact Report in 2023. And a quote that stood out to me was from Julie Kaufman, who's the partner and chief diversity officer from Bain & Company. And they said, DEI is not an initiative. It is the heart and soul of our talent strategy. If your business sees this as a core strategic imperative, you won't be cutting resources. And I think that's important, because a lot of times people think like, oh, it's just an HR recruiter thing, instead of recognizing it's the entire organization. It needs to be a strategic pillar, especially because out of 72% of the respondents of that report, they indicated there was continued backing for these DEI initiatives. and 92% of these respondents felt supported from their CEO. So that means, you know, their employees are paying attention to what their C-suite is doing.
Out of curiosity, as you said that you kind of you're a proud child of immigrants, you're a person of color. What do you think? What is the almost? What are you seeing as the strength of being someone who's kind of employed? And like, no, this is important. This is a strength that we have that might not be, you know, seen from other people. From, you know, what's the strength that marginalized groups can bring to a conversation, to a business? I wonder.
And once again, I'm saying this anecdotally, but in my experience with others that had similar backgrounds of, for example, being children of immigrants, we're third culture kids. Like, we have our home country's culture, the culture of the country we're living in, and then you have this nice blend and mix. And in my experience, interacting with other people that are third culture kids, regardless of the geographic location, we're more open to being innovative, to being risk takers. I recently learned about a term called STARS, and my friend Kyle from Radar introduced me to that term. And it's STARS stands for skilled through alternative routes. And I feel a lot of times people that are STARS tend to come from very diverse backgrounds, and they've recognized, because of their intersectional identities and depending on where they live, that their intersectional identities could be a detriment or a positive to them. And regardless of whether it's positive or negative, they're still navigating through these systems and figuring out how to make the best of a worse situation. And once again, anecdotally, in my experience, people who tend to be from disenfranchised, marginalized groups are the most innovative people I've ever met. They always look at things in a 360 holistic viewpoint, and they're not afraid to have those difficult conversations internally with the organizations and saying like, hey, why don't we take this approach? I don't think this is going to be successful. And a lot of times they try to stay connected with all these various groups, and especially coming from like a brand strategy standpoint, someone who's very open and interested in communicating, interacting with different people will help you when you're doing your qual research and you're having your focus groups. Because if you have someone who's only lived in their town, has never interacted with anyone that's different from them, that's not only going to give you a biased lens for your research, but that's also going to make it difficult if the junior members of that team are expressing to them of like, hey, I don't think the insights that you've generated are on point. I don't think the questions that we're asking will get us, you know, these really amazing, precious insights. Because, for example, brands that try to do strategy and insights in the Latin American market, and they use certain terminology, and they don't have that nuance of the culture. Like, I've seen some of these survey questions, and other people in the industry and sector that I've talked to that are from Latin America, we talk about how cringe some of these questions are. Because we're like, if you would have done your research, hired someone from local who is aware of the culture, that can provide you that nuance, you wouldn't be asking these embarrassing questions, especially for those such as myself that are third culture kids, where we read this and we're just rolling our eyes and saying like, okay, this is performative. And in today's age of social media, a lot of people can tell when a brand is being performative and not putting action behind the words they're espousing. And that gets reflected in their market share and people boycotting and people expressing with their financial power of, hey, I'm not going to be buying your product anymore because it's not reflecting my morals and ethics.
What advice would you give to leaders and organizations who do want to make, you know, shifts and a change in, you know, their DEI strategy?
I recommend investing in DEI and making sure that your current DEI team is fully supportive, because what I've seen here in the US is these are small teams of 5 people at max. And if you have, for example, a company that is spread out nationally or even internationally, and you only have 5 people just in charge of the entire DEI, that's daunting. That's overwhelming. So make sure that they have the support that they need, and also ensure that they're engaging and have access to the latest research. If not done internally, at least having access to external research and recognizing that there is value in having equitable contracts and deals with influencers or experts from different groups. Because another thing too is a lot of times when you're doing strategy and you're trying to glean insights from different groups that you're not a member of the community, it can be very exploitative and extractive. And a lot of times those who you have in your focus groups or interviews can feel that sometimes. And sometimes they may be afraid to bring themselves 100%. If they're not being able to express themselves fully, how are you going to get those deep insights that you're looking for? Especially in today's age where everyone says data is the new oil. If you can be the thought leader in your industry and sector, that sets you apart and that you set the standard. And if you set the standard, then that correlates to the amount of money you're making quarterly and at the end of the year.
Do you think the DEI team should sit almost with, you know, within HR? Does that work? Or do you think that they should have their own team, if that makes sense?
Personally, I think they should have their own team, but work very closely with the HR and recruitment teams. Because I feel like a lot of times when I've seen DEI just be under HR, they can be more focused on the HR compliance part instead of recognizing DEI is just more than HR compliance. It's looking to the future, recognizing the diversity that's present here, and also too, coming from the futurist lens, you know, the foresight lens of being open to how is diversity going to look like in the future? How's equity going to look like in the future? How's inclusion going to look like in the future? Because for example, accessibility, a lot of times companies and organizations don't recognize how that might look like in the future. Using the pandemic, for example, in the US, it's predicted that like by 2040, about 30 to 40% of US adults are going to have some type of disability because of having COVID. And the US isn't prepared for that. And I don't think the government, using them as an example, has factored in what the future accessibility is going to look like in the US. And how that ties into the business world is for DEI, if you're not taking into account how accessibility is currently formatted in legislations, but also too in like buildings, signs, language, you're not going to be prepared for those situations where it's an increase of accessibility requests and accessibility demands. So if you're combining the two, then you're as an organization, you'll be prepared, and then you won't have to be worried about like, oh my goodness, like we're being overwhelmed. No, we need to hire, you know, 10, 15 extra people for this, and then kind of throw something together last minute.
So almost what I'm hearing is, although, you know, HR is important and it's a factor that should work closely with HR, it's almost like HR is already thinking about quite a lot in terms of here and now and compliance and everything like that. Whereas if you had a team that's solely focused on DEI, they're constantly thinking about it. So they're thinking about the future and how to plan for that and bring that into strategy, not just thinking about perhaps other things and then, oh, don't forget DEI, and then thinking about that a little bit, but then perhaps being distracted or focusing on other things is what I'm hearing.
Exactly. So that way it's forefront of mind instead of an afterthought.
Kind of linking to the future part, and, you know, in my head, linking that's now linked with kind of emerging tech or tech that's happening now and potentially could grow. With the use of, you know, VR, AR, so virtual and augmented reality, and all the tech that's in that, how do you see these kinds of platforms impacting DEI? And, you know, how are the efforts changing? How are they perhaps creating, you know, more, perhaps less, you know, inclusive digital spaces?
Regarding emerging tech, I think one of the positives is it can potentially provide people the opportunity to experience someone's lived experience. Because as humans, we're able to engage in empathy. But at the same time, some of us, because just of how we process information or interact with information, we can understand it in theory, like empathize. But I believe having the opportunity through VR and AR to be someone from a disenfranchised, marginalized community in a virtual setting and experience those interactions, then it gives you a closer, more human touch to it. And I know people may say, like, well, how can you get a human touch to technology? But if you create these scenarios that you get the insights from people who've experienced it, because there definitely is not a lack of... there's not a lack of respondents who will vocalize their experience of, you know, being discriminated against or facing prejudice because of their intersectional identities. But something that I always vocalize to people is don't be over-reliant on technology, especially because it also is important to center who is going to be rolling out this technology, what parts of the world are going to have access to this first. Because as we've seen, those who have early access to something then shape and dictate how the culture around the tech, how the communities that use the tech or the online spaces that are related to the tech are created and fostered. And I always remind people, especially companies and brands in the global north and the west, of making sure that whatever tech they implement and roll out, that there is equitable access in the global South, because the global South population is increasing and more people in the global South are showcasing their talents, are showcasing their innovators, their creators, their creatives. And there's a lot of talent in the global South that I'm really excited and happy that they're finally getting spotlit and having these opportunities to showcase all their talents, because this is nothing new that we're aware of. Like, this talent has always been there. It's just with technology now allowing us the opportunity to be more connected with others from other parts of the world, we're able to see this and they're able to get their moments. And how I see it impacting DEI is, instead of doing those trainings online with seeing those videos that aren't really interactive in a way, I feel you can implement this technology where you can do it with other people, you know, do cohorts at the same time, and then you're able to experience these scenarios firsthand, and then you're able to then express and give feedback of, like, oh, okay, like, this is how this made me feel. And it can indicate and show to people the effects it has, you know, like the stress, the anxiety, the depression, you know, negative interactions in the workplace can have. Because a lot of times as human beings, we empathize with it, but when you feel it firsthand, it's different.
Is the way of what you were saying, you know, before earlier on in our discussion about, it's about how you feel and how that changes the way that you make decisions. I know, you know, it's all good and well seeing a video and be like, oh, you know, they obviously feel this, they obviously feel that. But until you really experience it, you don't know, you know, if you would freeze, if you would, you know, what you would actually do in that situation. That isn't just what you think the right answer should be, or, you know, the expected answer should be. But yeah, I guess, so on that kind of, I've asked a few questions. I wanted to explore a few topics with you. I know you have a lot more, you know, expertise and advice that you could give to others. But I guess kind of we've discussed a lot about DEI, your expertise, your thought leadership. But we also want to know a little bit more about kind of you and kind of what you think, and a little insight into who Emmanuel is. So we have a few quick fire questions. Just, you know, so we get an idea about you. So, yeah, I'll kind of dive straight in with question number one, being, what are some of your, you know, favorite places in the internet? So that, you know, that websites, threads that you follow. You mentioned animal memes at the beginning.
So I follow a lot of meme accounts on Instagram. just in my personal life, that way just grounds me, gives me joy,
and gives a glimpse into the cultural zeitgeist for different parts of the world. Because I follow a meme page that's from Brazil. I follow a meme page that's from Italy. I haven't found a meme page in part that's specific like for Latin America, but there are a few accounts that come across my feed that are in Spanish, and it clues me into the current internet culture and the cultural zeitgeist for the youth. And then I'm a big fan of LinkedIn, actually, but I think it's also because I follow a lot of people that are in cultural strategy, that are in research, that are in insights, that are futurists, that are strategic foresight practitioners. So I'm always seeing something interesting. And something that I encourage people to do if they want to kind of get their feet wet, so to speak, with futures thinking is choose a topic you'd like to, for example, like the future of books, and put that in your preferred internet search engine and put like future of books, and then you'll start getting different signals, and then you can start taking a look at that. Another place on the internet that I love is Discord, the collective that I'm part of, Radar. We're based on Discord, but we also do things off Discord. But I love Discord because you can find a lot of interesting communities on there that can be very niche. So if you're trying to look for a specific community and get insights from there, I feel like it provides more insight than Reddit. I'll go on Reddit occasionally, but it's like more the subreddit for futurism, like futurology. Because for me, I feel like if you're not familiar with that corner of the internet, it's very easy to fall into cesspools of very negative, detrimental thinking in communities. And I follow a lot of really interesting people on Twitter as well. But I feel like it can get overwhelming sometimes trying to navigate because of how it currently is. Because I only use Twitter on my phone. I don't use it on my computer. Another corner of the internet that I'm a fan of is Sublime Internet. And I actually contributed early research for their sign that came out that was talking about internet culture. And it was really interesting because the perspective I brought was how internet escapism can bring about opportunities to connect with others as communities, but it's also a double-edged sword because it can lead to isolationism and engaging in parasocial relationships. And if for anyone that's listening and unfamiliar with the term parasocial, it means when someone thinks that they have a personal connection with either a celebrity, it's generally geared towards more online content creators. So because you've viewed their content and they've shared so much of their life, of course, people need to recognize that it's a curated, edited version of their personal life. Then they start thinking like, oh, this person is my friend. I know everything about them, without realizing, no, you actually are not their friend. There have been instances in the early days of content creation where fans have become actual friends of the content creators, but I feel like in presently it's almost impossible nowadays because of safety, because of people just not wanting to risk exposing themselves to, agents of chaos, so to speak, of people with nefarious intentions. And then another, I don't have a specific arena board that I follow, but whenever members of Radar post arena boards, I'll check them out and see them. One of my fellow Radar members, her name's Liv, she has a board on kind of like the future of romance and relationships and connections, which I find really interesting. And I share with her like signals that I see every once in a while, because that's also another future area that I'm really interested in.
I wonder, for almost my next question, so what advice would you give to your younger self?
Present me would let my younger self know that you don't have to stress as much regarding your professional journey, because I used to always be stressing and thinking like by the age of 30, I need to be here professionally, and recognizing that as humans have increased their lifespan, we've also increased our opportunity to be successful. And I look at individuals that are in their 40s or 50s or 60s, and some, like, for example, Iris Apfel, the fashion icon, who became much more celebrated in later stages of her life.
Yeah, I think that's a super important message to give to anyone at any age, which is, a nice one. I guess, Emmanuel, I have one more question for you, and it's a question that we ask everyone on the podcast, the very different answers. On a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you?
On a professional level, I'd say like a 6.5, because I feel like you want someone that has, quote unquote, a certain level of weirdness, because they're going to be open to different types of formats when it comes to creation and creativity, ideation, innovation. Professionally, personally, I would say probably like me in my personal life, maybe like an 8.5.
I really appreciate your time, and actually I've learned quite a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to interacting with everyone on Label Sessions.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.